States against Miller. Ms. Sweeney.
To please the court, good morning. My name is...
You can lower the podium some. There's a... No, the podium. Switch on the lower right.
I think I'm fine, Judge. I'm
don't move the microphone.
Oh, don't move the microphone. Okay. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Kathleen Sweeney, and I represent Dwayne Miller, the appellant, and the defendant below. Mr. Miller was charged with one count of conspiracy to possess and distribute ecstasy and two counts of knowingly distributing ecstasy. A jury found him guilty of the conspiracy count and one distribution count. I want to move into knowing what the court has said about Blakely, but there have been some questions, I think, Judge Cudahy, that I think I can answer and raise by the United States. In this case, Mr. Miller, after the court found a base offense level, was sentenced enhanced to 2 points of obstruction of justice based on his trial testimony. The trial court also indicated that he could not consider role in the offense because of the he attributed only the personal amount of drugs to Mr. Miller. The United States has suggested that this is only a statutory error, that the court erred because they applied mandatory guidelines that we now know are advisory. However, this is also a constitutional error in that the sentence went beyond the jury verdict and Mr. Miller's criminal history. Judge Cudahy asked about obstruction. Well, actually, I believe that Mr. Miller's case fits Booker's exactly. Booker was also enhanced on obstruction because he said, yes, there might have been drugs in my duffel bag, but I didn't know about them.
Let me ask the constitutional question in a different way.
Yes, sir.
What facts were found here by a preponderance over defendant's objection?
Well, Your Honor, you can infer that no legal representative of the accused is going to agree that he lied in court. So the judge did, in fact, obstruct based on his trial testimony. No trial counsel did not say, I object to you finding that my client lied. I think that's an inference that he would necessarily disagree with that finding.
Look, Blakely and Booker were clear that if the defendant agrees to the facts, if there's no fact-finding over objection, then there's no problem. And it's consistent with the Sixth Amendment all along. You don't have to contest facts. You can agree to them. That's what leads to my question. What facts were found here over the defendant's objection?
Well, Your Honor, I think I might answer it a different way, which is that Booker said a judge cannot make a determination beyond the jury verdict without in violation of the Sixth Amendment. And in this case, the only jury verdict was to conspiracy to possess and distribute ecstasy. That's what the jury verdict was, and I believe that's what Booker said the constitutional violation is, and that's what the trial court did in this case, rising to the level of constitutional error. So in plain error is met in Mr. Miller's case that would require it being sent back for resentencing. Just like Booker, he said, he testified, may have been drugs, I didn't know.
I would like you to be concrete. Was there a dispute here of the kind, defendant says the drug quantity is X, the prosecutor says it is X plus Y, the judge finds X plus Y? It looks like quite the contrary. It looks like there was a disagreement about the drug quantity and the district judge sided with the defendant.
That's correct.
So I don't understand what facts were being found over the defendant's objection.
That he obstructed justice, that he lied at trial. He did not object to that. But again, my reading...
Well, we come back to over the defendant's objection, and of course, whether he lied at trial is, one might think, something that the jury had already determined.
But the jury did not determine that. He was not charged.
Was there a possibility that the jury could have convicted him if it believed all of his testimony?
I think it's possible, probably not likely.
Could you explain how it would be possible?
I think, if I recall Mr. Miller's testimony correctly, I believe that he said he came to know that his co-defendant, Mr. Holman, was dealing drugs. He did not know at the one time he was personally involved in the delivery.
Did he deny the delivery?
He did not deny handing the undercover agent a bag. He denied the contents, similar to...
Oh, he said he didn't know what was in the bag, right?
That's correct. So, most likely, no, a jury probably did not believe that. However, that is, again, not what Booker tells us the standard is currently. And the standard is that this was not presented, the alleged perjury, to the jury for determination. So that this is a...
That's the question I'm asking.
Yes, sir.
Maybe I've missed your answer, but if the conviction itself has to depend on a belief that the defendant was not telling the truth, then the jury has determined beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was not telling the truth. Otherwise, he would have been acquitted.
Well, I'm not sure I agree that the conviction depends totally on his testimony. I think that, again, the verdict is to a drug dealing charge. The verdict is not to perjury. And every single case in both the Fourth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit and Booker, there were obstruction of justice enhancements that involved trial testimony, and each of these circuits have interpreted Booker and Oliver and Hughes and sent them directly back to the trial court for resentencing, finding that plain error had been met. And in fact, this court has done that routinely with most of the cases it did send back for resentencing prior to the Supreme Court answering the Booker question. So it would be my...
By the way, I noticed that your supplemental post-Booker brief doesn't mention plain error.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. It does not.
Why should we find plain error when you have never made an argument, despite the fact that we gave you an opportunity to do so, that there is plain error?
Well, Your Honor, because I think Booker is still controlling in the United States.
Booker said that normal prudential doctrines, including plain error, must be applied.
What?
And you can bet we're going to follow Booker.
And I'd suggest...
Then you file a brief that doesn't make any argument that there is plain error.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. But again, the Booker and the Blakely issue was raised on direct appeal. I think it's been preserved. Because I may not have properly interpreted Booker in my supplemental brief does not mean that Mr. Miller has not met the plain error standard. And in fact, I think you can read Booker to almost create a negative implication that when they say not all cases rise to a Sixth Amendment violation, and then we look at perhaps harmless error. But this case, it does rise to a Sixth Amendment violation. I'd like to move on to the conspiracy count. The United States alleged 5 overt acts involving Mr. Holman. 3 of those acts involved Mr. Miller. 2 of the acts actually were also charged as the substantive counts for knowingly distributing ecstasy. Mr. Miller was found guilty of only 1 of those counts. The United States notes that in U.S. versus Rock that there, in order to find Mr. Miller guilty, that there was sufficient evidence of the conspiracy charge, there must be more than the buyer-seller relationship. And in Rock's case, the co-defendant was actually the person dealing with the undercover agents, and Mr. Rock was allegedly selling or providing the drugs to the co-defendant. And in this particular case, Mr. Miller, the United States has not met that burden regarding the buyer and seller relationship. We know that Mr. Miller was present only at one of the buys, that he is not recorded in any type of conversation. They found no money, no drugs on him or in person. And in fact, at the day the arrest went down, agent at the trial identified Mr. Miller coming out of the apartment, and that was not even Mr. Miller. That was his brother and someone and who also frequented that address. So I would suggest that to the court that that buyer-seller relationship that the United States relies on as proving and establishing sufficiency, in fact, does not. And briefly then, I would move just to the substitute counsel argument. I do not raise this, and I know that it is true in this circuit that ineffective assistance of counsel on a direct appeal should not be raised. What I want to suggest in reading Houston, Zornick, I think I pronounced that wrong, is that there are times when the colloquy between the judge and the accused is so lacking in any type of interaction that that in and of itself implicates Sixth Amendment concerns. And in and of itself, because there is such a strong tradition, especially in this circuit, of a person accused of a crime being able to retain counsel of his or her choice, that the later question of whether or not counsel was effective need not be answered, but instead that there has to be meaningful colloquy, and there was not.
But here, even if we say that it wasn't meaningful, we're again dealing with an abuse of discretion standard, and you really haven't shown us where counsel was incompetent, that he was forced to proceed with. This was the counsel you'd had for several months, very familiar with the case, tried the case. I haven't seen any strong argument or really to suggest that he didn't receive effective assistance.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not answering that question. I don't think that because I don't think this is necessarily the appropriate form for that. I think that there, in the cases that I've reviewed, there may have been a finding that there was no colloquy. Then they went to the effective assistance of counsel. But here, I guess I'm asking the court to consider whether or not you even get to that piece when there's such an absence.
And I understand we don't have an IAC claim. I understand that, and that would be for a later day. But what I'm saying to you is you then need to show us some prejudice. I understand we're not ruling on the IAC claim, but give me some error that counsel committed, you know, to show that this was a harmful versus a harmless, even if we buy into it being an error. Give me something.
Based on the record between the trial court and the trial counsel, I believe that the trial counsel sufficiently outlined preparation to go forward for trial on that day. I would agree with that. I do think, again, this was a client who had never been in the criminal justice system. At no point did the trial court ask him, why do you wish to have different counsel? Why have you gone to the trouble of retaining counsel? Mm-hmm. And I think that answer probably did not relate to preparation, and that's where the meaningful colloquy becomes so important as a Sixth Amendment right.
So you're just saying on its face, the fact that he requested the day before trial to have counsel and that the colloquy between the court was the court didn't ask that question, didn't get a response on its face, that's error, that's enough for us to reverse.
Yes, ma'am, I would. Any other questions? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Sweeney. Mr. Blackburn.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'd like to go in inverse order regarding the new counsel claim, again, to put it in its proper backdrop. Case has been continued three times in defense motions at 4:07 and the last business day before trial. We have the request for a new counsel and a new attorney. And I do think that the court could have and should have conducted a better dialogue with the defendant to ask him why he wanted a new lawyer. I was asked to leave the courtroom during that discussion. I couldn't have done anything to facilitate that. But the fact is that both the Houston and Bjorkman cases say that in order for an appellant to prevail in that argument, they've got to show prejudice. They have to show that the court deprived him of his right to effective assistance of counsel, and there's absolutely nothing that's been suggested that trial counsel was ineffective in any way. Regarding the sufficiency of
Let's go back to that. You certainly, I understand you weren't there when the judge asked the questions, but you certainly had an opportunity to suggest to the court what questions could be asked.
The court had cited, I believe it was the Houston case in its dialogue with the defendant, so I'd assume that the district court had read that and would ask the appropriate questions of the defendant at that point in time.
Right. You made an assumption. I understand that case exists, but I'm just saying you had an opportunity to make sure the court followed that procedure.
I had the opportunity to suggest questions, but when the court had cited the Houston cases, I believe, I'd assume the court would subsequently ask those questions of the defendant, specifically, why do you want a new lawyer? Perhaps I could have asked the court, you know, have you read the Houston case, and will you ask those questions? I didn't do that in this case, but I think in any event, there's no showing of ineffective assistance of counsel. Regarding the sufficiency of the evidence, we have a hand-to-hand deal on the delivery charge between the defendant and an undercover officer. And again, in the conspiracy charge, as I've outlined in the brief, the defendant and his charged conspirator were agreeing to sell drugs to an ascertained individual, and under Rock were on the same side of the transaction. So I think a conspiracy exists. Moving to Booker, I don't want to beat a dead horse. I was here last week on the same issue, and there have been a lot of arguments. But I think that defense counsel has mischaracterized the exact error that we should be looking at here. When the Seventh Circuit first considered the Booker opinion, before it had gotten to the Supreme Court, we'd all assumed that the error was a constitutional question, and that the error raised was the failure to submit these sentencing-enhancing facts to the jury. What the Supreme Court told us in their opinion was, yes, that was an error, but the remedy from that error is we are going to strike the statutory provisions that render the guidelines binding. So the remedy for that violation is to make the guidelines non-binding. What I think that this court should be looking at now in terms of error and under the plain error doctrine is...
I'm not yet convinced there was any error in this case. I don't think we need more argument on them.
Okay, I don't think so either, Your Honor.
I wonder, however, whether there was an error in this case.
I don't think
there
was.
Can you articulate any fact found over the defendant's objection on any standard?
No. In fact, the defendant's objection to the weight of the controlled substance was resolved in the defendant's
favor.
And the obstruction... wasn't raised, and it's pretty self-evident.
Let me ask the same question I asked your adversary. Would it have been possible for the jury to have believed all of the defendant's material testimony and convicted?
No. Because the defendant says, okay, I gave the package to the undercover officer. I didn't know what was in the package.
Knowledge is an element
of the offense. So if you know, the jury accepts the defendant's version and believes he doesn't know what's in the package, he's not guilty.
And that establishes lack of error in your opinion. Is there any consequence flow from the fact that the Judge Hamilton here was mistakenly under the impression that he was under the compulsion to follow the guidelines once this obstruction is established?
And that's where I was going. That is, as we know now, an error now.
No, that's the question. You don't get to the remedy for a Sixth Amendment error unless there was a Sixth Amendment error. If there's no Sixth Amendment error, if all the facts are established or stipulated by the defendant, then there's no remedy.
I don't think there is a Sixth Amendment error, but you know, I do think if the court would determine that the district court erred in finding that the guidelines were binding, we'd go then to the plain error standard, and there's a lack of prejudice, and I'd make those arguments that have been raised, I'm sure, before.
But that was a remedial error, and the point is you don't get to the remedy in this case.
Right? I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think so. I'm trying to follow assumptions. If the court rules a certain way and finds an error, then we would go to the plain error doctrine. But I don't have anything to say in the rest of my time unless the court has any specific questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Sweeney?
Your Honor, just that the remedy that Mr. Miller seeks is a new sentencing hearing, is a vacating of his convictions and or a new trial. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And Ms. Sweeney, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment.